Hello?
What happened there?
I don't know. Is Chris here?
Did we really lose Chris, or is he just being quiet to make this part weird?
I don't know.
Since he's in control of the editing, he can make this part very uncomfortable to listen to.
Like all of our other episodes.
You are now listening to NPC Cast, your place for face-to-face games.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to NPC Cast, your place for face-to-face games. My name is Chris, and I'm coming to you from sunny Seattle, Washington. And like I typically do, I've gotten into the habit of doing this at least, I have brought a couple of NPCs along for the ride with me from the far west, east, where I forget where we said you're from. Dang it.
I don't remember either.
Anyways, from a remote location, he is NPC Aaron. Aaron, how are you doing?
I am doing well.
Why are you remote today?
Because I didn't want to drive up there.
Legit.
Yeah.
That's all.
Uh-huh. Sure. Coming to us from the frozen tundra of the north, he's NPC Del Del. How are you doing?
Hang on. I gotta build another level in Tiny Death Star.
What is Tiny Death Star?
It's you micromanage a Tiny Death Star on your phone.
I'm sure you do.
It's adorable.
And now we're going to have to send him a bill for that plug.
Yeah.
Look at what you've done, Del.
Did you guys see on Twitter that I tweeted out into the universe that we're trying to figure out ways for us to be able to let people support our podcast financially without compromising our integrity because we want to be able to sleep at night, which... by the way, we do on Anthology Embroidered Linens, available from Bed Bath & Beyond in a lavish assortment of colors and patterns. If you want to tell us your thread count, you can do that by going to Twitter. My Twitter handle is at NPC Chris. Aaron.
At NPC Aaron.
Del.
At NPC Del.
Or you can tweet at the whole family at NPC Cast. You can, of course, go to our Facebook page. What is the address for that, Aaron?
It is facebook.com/NPCcast.
And, of course, if you would like to send us an email, you want to get all your thoughts out in a really long, elaborate, multi-part email, you can very simply do that by going to thenpccast@gmail.com. All right. We got that out of the way. Feeling good. Now, it's we're getting into a stretch of the year that is a little bit unusual. Is that fair to say, guys?
In that, the holidays are unusual to you?
They happen every year. I'm used to them by now.
I've lived through them 28 other times. I feel like it's the usual.
Oh, well, in that case, what is the topic for today's show, Del?
It is gaming with your family. You guys are like my family, but you are actually gamers. We're talking about gaming with the people who you can get kidneys from, who are generally not gamers.
How you Del mean transients? Family. Del defines family as people he can contact if he needs an organ.
I mean, I know about a half dozen people I can call and get organs from in a pinch if I need them. But I mean, they're not always, it's not always on the up and up, but I mean, they're on ice, so that's good. So for today's topic, we're going to be talking about games that you can play with your family, who the family members that may not necessarily be gamers, but we're going to try to figure out ways that we can coax them into enjoying the hobby that we all love, which is board games, tabletop games, face-to-face games. So the first thing that you have to think about is... a lot of your family are going to have some preconceived notions about what board games are. Your goal in the limited time that you have with them, the limited time that you're forced to spend with them, is to sort of enlighten them as to what is really, really cool about board games. Part of the problem, and I don't know if you guys would agree with this, is that there's a stigma that comes with board games, and I call it... The Monopoly syndrome. Can you elaborate a little bit on why Monopoly may not be the best game to play with your family, Del?
Because it was designed to be awful. It was specifically designed to illustrate how awful Monopolies are. It's not fun, and it doesn't end. It doesn't have a defined end point either.
When you were growing up, did you play a lot of board games at family gatherings, either of you guys?
We played a lot of board games in my family whenever the power went out. That's pretty much the only time.
We played card games and backgammon.
The big one for my family, growing up, I remember very, very specifically, is we did a lot of Trivial Pursuit. It was always like men versus women in Trivial Pursuit. And I remember this very specifically because one year what comic book company created the Hulk or whatever. And I was on, you know, I was probably like 8 or 9, and I was on like the guys team. And it was, I think one of my uncles answered DC. And my cousin, who was holding the card, it was like, yep, that's right. And then on the drive home, I was like, hey, Mom, like, Hulk's not actually DC, he's Marvel. And my mom stopped the car, turned around to go back to my aunt's house to let them know that we had cheated, that the men had cheated at Trivial Pursuit. And I don't think we played it again after that. That was like the last year in which we played. But those are the experiences I had growing up playing board games with my family members. Last year, actually, was a new experience, and I think I talked about it on the show a little bit, but I had actually played Resistance. I brought Resistance to Christmas Eve dinner, and we played some Resistance, and my parents and my aunt were horrible at it, but we had a good time, and it was sort of, it was the first time I had tried to introduce the games that I'm into at, you know, a family event. So this show is going to be about those types of experiences, trying to basically expand your family's horizons to get them to play games that you might be into as well, that you might actually play, you know, for fun and not just because it's the thing that you do when it's you're full of turkey or whatever. So right at the top, let's just list some of the games that we think are really strong to sort of introduce to family members and explain a little bit about why those games are good. Aaron, what's one of the top games on your list of games to introduce?
Snake Oil.
Yes.
Because it is one of the best party games, and it's very easy to teach people. And my family is mostly very extroverted, very loud people, and that's the perfect kind of people to play that game. So, that would probably be one of the first ones I would show up with.
Yeah, I think that's a definitely good choice. The good thing about Snake Oil as well is that people can sort of come in and play it for a little bit and then leave. You know, apples to apples is the same way, where it's like you can come to the table and you can sit down and play a few rounds, and then if you know you got to go to the next house or whatever, you can do that as well. Obviously, a lot of this advice is going to be malleable based on the way that your families conduct gatherings. I mean, I have a pretty large extended family in the area, so a lot of times I'll have cousins that will show up and they can only, you know, hang out for 30 to 45 minutes before they have to go to, you know, another house or, you know, like their girlfriend's house or whatever. We're going to be talking a lot about games based on, you know, our experiences, but obviously you want to tailor these to the way that your gatherings are conducted. But yeah, Snake Oil is definitely near the top of my list. One of the downsides to Snake Oil is that it relies on the group of people to want to play it. It's very difficult to play Snake Oil with players who don't really want to play the game. So if you're playing a game like Snake Oil, you have to sort of pitch it in a way that makes it seem fun. You have to convince them to actually want to play the game. Is that pretty fair to say, Del?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you have someone who's like, I don't know, you know, car horse, and it's a horse shaped car. I'm done.
Like, that's, I don't know. I probably would give the point to that.
That's very useful. I can't think of a profession when that would not be useful. Cheerleader, car horse.
Think I want about a car it. Horse right now.
But yeah, if someone is getting roped into it, and that's like you said, if and that's true of most games, but especially the party style games, if someone's getting roped into it, one person can drag down the entire session or the entire group easily.
Now on the flip side of that, because it's so easy to jump in and out, it's very easy to say hey, Uncle Bobby, you want to play Snecko with us? He's like, no, I don't really want to. Be like, all right, you know, you're a loss, and then start playing it. And, you know, Uncle Bobby's kind of watching the game and seeing how it works. And then, you know, in a few minutes, you can be like, are you sure you don't want to play? We can just give you some cards. And then, you know, after they've seen it played and they see everyone else having a good time, they can be, you know, easier to coax into to join in on the festivities. Whereas if you play a game such as Ticket to Ride, you know, it's very difficult to add someone in to a Ticket to Ride game. However, I would say that Ticket to Ride is also a very good game to play at family gatherings, you know, for a variety of other reasons. I know that, Aaron, you consider Ticket to Ride one of the best games to teach sort of newbie players. Why is that?
Because it has very few rules, but it's still pretty strategic.
I would say it's baby's first action economy.
Yeah. Sure, I guess, and that you can do one. Your action economy is you can do one action. So I just think that in general, people get into it. It's a theme that doesn't necessarily scare any particular audience away. You know, no, but there's no weird Larry Elmore painting of a dragon on the cover or anything. So I think it's pretty easy to get people to play. There's a few other games that are kind of in that vein as well that will work for these kind of gatherings, even though they're more strategy games than they are party games.
Like, give me another example.
Takedo would be a good one.
Ding.
I think...
Check that off this podcast.
Yeah, I think Takedo would work pretty well. I think some of the other light games... Rise of Augustus would be pretty good, since its core mechanic is bingo. It's pretty easy to teach.
At this point, I mean, I feel as though Settlers of Catan should be in the conversation, but it's almost like, I mean, every household has this game. Like, I'm pretty sure my parents own a Settlers of Catan game for reasons that I have no idea.
Carcassonne, that would be another good one.
Carcassonne is another great example. One of the things, and I will take sort of Takedo out of this conversation for a second, even though I do think it's a good game to introduce people to, but the thing with Carcassonne, Settlers, Ticket to Ride, these styles of games, is that the boards look very approachable. Like, you look at the Ticket to Ride board, and it doesn't seem overly complex. You know, you're not going to have like all sorts of, you know, rules written on them and like really complex boards within boards. You don't have unique player boards, that kind of stuff. So it's a little bit easier for people to just look at. And then when you're giving the pitch, say, you know, this game is about us sort of building out the French countryside. And we're going to do it by placing these like cool colored tiles. And people will be like, okay, that seems pretty easy to understand, pretty easy to comprehend. Now, Takedo, obviously, because it has a lot of little bits to it, the board can look sort of intimidating a little bit. However, it makes up for that by having really awesome artwork.
Yeah, it's just so pretty that it lulls you into a sense of security.
Right. It's like, how could anything this cute be difficult?
I mean, I think what we're going to find in our suggestions is that they fall into kind of one of four camps, essentially. So the camp we're just talking about is the very light strategy game. That's going to be the smallest one, I think, as far as the number of games that are suitable. Mm-hmm. You're also going to your deduction intrigue games that can put a lot of people in. Werewolf, Mafia, Resistance, Avalon, Bloodbound. All those games can work because they're very easy to teach people, and they're all about lying, which is a big part of family. And you can also do actual party games like Snake Oil, Anomia, apples to apples, Cards Against Humanity, if that's the kind of family you have, that's the kind of family
I
have.
Messed up so. Family, bro.
Yeah. and then the last kind, was that four?
That was three.
Oh, the last kind is probably some cooperative games.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. I think we're going to hit all those, kind of going through and give our suggestions. Now, I want to do something a little bit more difficult because, you know, we're obviously gamers. But in fairness, you know, when you're playing games with your family, not all the games that we're going to be into are games that we would, you know, we would bring to, you know, the table after it's cleared of all the Thanksgiving feast type foods. So what are some games that you guys really like but feel are not good for, you know, the family gatherings with sort of non-gamers?
Any role-playing game.
Correct.
Yeah.
Fiasco.
I think that's pretty fair. Wait, you think Fiasco is one of the worst?
I think Fiasco is not appropriate for family gatherings. Mm-hmm. I think it just takes a little bit too long, and everybody has to sit there and talk when it's their turn. I think it's just a little bit too complex for a family to quickly understand the idea. I've taught Fiasco to gamer friends of mine and non-gamer friends of mine, but I would not try and foist Fiasco onto someone who has never conceived of an RPG beyond knowing that D&D exists.
Can we get a judge's ruling on the word foist? Is that really a thing?
I think it is. Pretty sure.
F-O-I-S-T.
Okay. Well, I'll look it up later. If I'll just edit this whole part out if it's not really a word. Well, one thing I think about Fiasco, and Fiasco is one of my favorite games, but it's the type of game that sort of makes assumptions. Like, it's very difficult to sort of have that be your first introduction into storytelling style of games. Like, you have to feel comfortable, at least, you know, in a storytelling situation to be able to play a game of Fiasco. Aaron, you were going to say something, though, before I cut you off.
Oh, I was going to say you probably don't want to bring complicated Euro games to the holiday table. Like, I love, obviously, like, Hansa Teutonica or Terra Mystica, but they don't really belong at my family's house because nobody would want to play them or understand them.
Yeah. And just on a physical security standpoint, Terra Mystica has tons of little tiny bits, and I don't know about you guys, but our Thanksgivings, when I get to go to them, are full of 3 to 5 year old kids running around putting literally every object they can find into their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So something that only has cards, like a resistance, is probably safer than something that has thousands and thousands of wooden cubes.
Yeah,
I don't know. I call that natural selection, I think.
Well, then you have to get that piece back from in 4 to 6 hours.
That's the hard part.
Yeah, yeah, Dell doesn't mean safer for the child. He means safer for your board game collection.
Oh, correct. Good point. All right. Yeah. Thanks for looking out, Dell.
I think there's different parts of an evening when it comes to these gatherings. I think that there's the part where it's like you just had dinner, and then, you know, games like Apples to Apples, Anomia, you know, things of this nature might be good for those types of games. But there's also the portion of the evening when it's like a lot of the people have left, you know, maybe like you're cleaning up the dishes. You got your Yule log going, and it's like, you know, just a few of your closer family members around. Then you can kind of start playing maybe a little more complicated games with a little bit more pieces. But there's a certain, at least in my family, and maybe I'm putting my family on blast here, but there's a certain chaotic nature to the way that the events usually unfold as the evening goes on. Invariably, some portion of food will get prepared poorly, or there will be something missing from a recipe, or someone will not have their favorite beverage, and so you'll have family members coming in and out, going to the store, you know, putting out fires, literally. you know, heading off to wherever they need to go, to the next person's house to say hi to them and, you know, exchange gifts and all these things that are going on. So there's definitely different times when you want to introduce different styles of games based on the vibe that you're getting in the room. Now, Del, something that you had mentioned earlier was the idea of playing cooperative games at family gatherings as opposed to playing, you know, competitive games. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages to that? You don't have to go into too much detail because we did a whole episode about cooperative games, but just in the light of playing games with your family members, what are some of the strengths and weaknesses of cooperative games?
The strength of a co-op game in a setting with low information gamers, as we'll call family, the advantage is that in a co-op game, coaching and helping them out and supporting them and cheering when they, you know, are successful on their turn is good. Whereas with a competitive game, it's very easy to have somebody who doesn't really understand the game make a couple crucial errors and then not have fun the rest of the night. And that's not great for family harmony. You know, plus it's great when everyone can win and everybody high fives and says how much fun this is. And aren't you the best, you know, best nephew ever for thinking of this?
Aaron, what are your thoughts on cooperative versus competitive games?
Well, I mean, you know, this whole topic is a your mileage may vary kind of thing based on your family. But I'm hyper competitive because everyone in my family is hyper-competitive. So I actually don't know that for my family, cooperative games would go over that well for the most part. I think that there are members of my family who, when they sit down to beat everyone else at the table.
And I was born in the darkness, molded by it. I did not see a cooperative game until I was a man.
Exactly. So, for my family, competitive is better, but I could see that in general, it's very easy to teach cooperative games as you go, because when you're showing an example turn, that example isn't threatening everyone else at the table. It's helping.
Yeah, I think for me personally, and I guess I'll give you know my perspective coming from my family. For competitive games, it's okay. I mean, you know, as was the story of the Trivial Pursuit, obviously I have some very competitive family members. That being said, it has to be sort of a low stakes type of competition. What I don't want to introduce to in a family gathering is something where there's going to be a game with a lot of analysis paralysis. There's going to be, you know, an influx of too many choices on a given turn. I think my family does well, you know, playing competitively because, you know, they like to win. But, I mean, they like to win in the sense that, you know, you can win apples to apples or you can win Dixit, you know. But the act of playing the game is also sort of enough for some of them.
Does that mean I can if your family's not that competitive, does that mean you wouldn't bring Double Entendre the Giant with you and have deck registrations for casual Magic?
No. Okay. Magic is sort of the dark horse, because I see MTG on these show notes. I don't know how they got there. I'll give the audience three guesses as to who wrote these show notes that they include MTG on them. But that said, what do you think of games like MTG, Aaron?
I think that MTG, unless your family all already play, is a terrible, terrible idea. It's a very complicated game. And I mean, you could make very, like, quote-unquote, dumbed-down decks to play against each other, but it's still just not simple. It's not appealing to, like, non-gamers a lot of the time. You know, there's, you know, griffins and dragons and manticores and lizard. You know, there's just a bunch of stuff on the card that my mom doesn't care about. So I think that Magic is a terrible idea for a family gathering game myself.
Here's what I want to say in defense of Magic the Gathering as a game. Is I can imagine a situation a few years down the road when my nephew shows up to, you know, a family function, and he's old enough to sort of that he's that age, you know, he's in the 9, 10, 11 year old age where I was when I started playing Magic the Gathering. I can imagine a circumstance where I will pull him aside, you know, after we've eaten dessert, and I will show him Magic, and I'll be like, look at these awesome cards. Here, let me teach you this game. And I'll sit down and I'll teach him. The problem with a game like Magic, though, is that it, because it is so complicated, it takes a lot of instruction, and it's hard to do that amount of instruction with a group of people. It's easier to teach that game on a one-to-one basis, whereas if I'm trying to, like, you know, get three or four people in, you know, they all kind of have to share a hand, or, you know, you have to show them your hand while you're going through these sample turns and explaining things, and everyone is, some people are, you know, you mentioned summoning sickness, and someone gets it immediately, and then someone has a question, well, does every creature have summoning sickness? Yes. Does summoning sickness, blah, blah, blah. What about blocking? Blah, blah, blah. All these things. And so you have to deal with a lot of questions from a lot of people. In the same way that's one of the bad parts about playing, you know, more complex games. I see Battlestar Galactica on this list of games to talk about because we all three of us really love Battlestar Galactica. It's I think, one of the games that our playgroup will oftentimes go back to and use it as like a default fallback option in playing games. But it has a lot of different elements that are working together in that game. And so it makes it tough to teach it to a group of non-gamers in one go. So I think that the key is keeping that learning curve low. You want to make sure that you're teaching a game that, you know, can be taught quickly, and then, you know, most of the learning can come through actually playing the game. That's what's good about, like, you know, Ticket to Ride, Carcassonne, even Settlers to a lesser extent, is that I can tell you the basics, and I can be like, you know what, let's just start playing. You'll pick it up in no time, and then just go running with it. Del, do you want to say anything about Magic the Gathering, though?
I will say that I agree mostly with your assessment. I think that keeping a spare standard deck or two in your car's center console when you show up, just in case, like you said, there's a nephew or, you know, somebody else who is about your age and wants to get away from watching the Lions game for a little bit and play some cards, sling some spells, that option is available to you.
I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, I can imagine a circumstance where it'd be good, but the crux of what we're going to be talking about are games that are a little bit better with groups of people.
Right. So I can't bring my cube.
No, you cannot bring your cube.
No, Grandma, you first picked the Grim Monolith. It leaves you open in other colors.
Are you stupid? I was sending a clear signal by passing that. I mean, how did you end up in blue? Seriously. Oh, I was totally cutting it.
Noobs.
Noobs. Oh. So let's talk about the idea of teaching games. Now, a lot of times you're going to be teaching games to people, and because, you know, obviously they're new players and they are, you know, noobs. Grandma doesn't know how to draft. She's never done it before. What are your thoughts on sort of maintaining your own personal competitive level? How do you go about sort of keeping your cool, or do you? I mean, Aaron, you said that you were sort of molded by the competitive fires of your family. I mean, when you sit down to play with them, are you sitting down to tear their throats out?
That family, yes. But for instance, my wife does not have that ultra competitive feeling. So when I have taught games to her or to her family at their family gatherings, it has not. I have to temper my own competitive nature and just play for the experience. I act like I'm learning the game with them in order to psychologically trick myself into not caring about winning.
It's tough. It's one of those things where it's like, sometimes it's tough to lose to somebody that you know you can't just, like, stop talking to them. Like, losing in a tournament, it's like you feel bad, but like that person's not going to be around next week, next month, next year to rub it in your face, you know?
Except for that time that you lost to Dell at that PTQ.
Yeah. Yeah, there was that time, wasn't there? Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay, well, how do we get matched up in the PTQ, honestly?
I don't know, but
completely
it was magical.
Randomly. Oh, good times. Now, when you said, Aaron, when you're teaching these games, you go through it as though you're learning the game as well. Do you extend that to, you know, helping them with their turn, or how do you go about doing that? Is there certain games where it's I guess more necessary to give hints for how to play, or do you kind of just let them ask their own questions and hope that they'll ask the right ones?
I tend to let them ask their own questions. I'm always there to remind them what they can do with their turn as far as what actions are available. I try not to point to any specific things they could do, because in a competitive game, even if you're being kind of lax, when you give somebody a hint, oftentimes that action that you're hinting is at the expense of somebody else whose turn it is not. For instance, if I'm like, oh, well, if you have 4 red trains, you could take, you know, Kansas City to Denver, or whatever. And I give that to them, and then somebody else was waiting for that and, you know, hoping that that person didn't see it. Though I may have helped one person and made them feel good, I may have made another person a little upset.
Yeah, it's hard to sort of to be even when it comes to giving out those hints. Now, of course, if you have, you know, least favorite family members, feel free to, you know, conspire against them.
Play favorites, even if they're your children, you know.
Yeah, it teaches them that
they should know
where they stand. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. On the show notes here, we have party games that's sort of bolded, it's highlighted. Again, to give some examples, these are games like Resistance, Apples to Apples, Snake Oil, Anomia.
Wits and Wagers, light trivia or word games in there too, I think.
Right, I think we mentioned sort of at the top, or at least I mentioned one of my favorite things about these style of games. Some more than others, obviously, but I like introducing games where people can get in, play for a little bit, and then get out. You know, in games like Apples to Apples, Snake Oil, people can just come in, grab some cards, and start playing. If you look at Flux, Flux literally says in the rules, you know, if a new player comes to the table, give them 7 cards and just continue to play. Like, it's not even a big thing. Games like Resistance, where, you know, for the most part, it's sort of easy to understand. It moves relatively briskly so that you can, you know, you never plan an evening to play Resistance and then play one game. You know, you play one and then, oh, Spies won, let's do it again. And you chain games of Resistance. And I think that games like that are good because someone can come in and then they can get out before, you know, they need to open up their present, or they can show up a little bit later to the party and then jump in the next game, and there's a very quick turnaround. What are some other strengths with party games in general, besides the fact that, you know, people can jump in and out? Do you guys have any other thoughts on that?
Their rules often fit on a single page.
Yes.
So it is very easy to just be like, you know, if you're in the middle and you can't explain the rules for the next round, you can pass the single page, or in the case of Snake Oil, the side of the box to them, and they could see if they really want to play without them having to sit down and read a lot.
I would say that another thing is there isn't a board a lot of times, and you don't need a table. You can do it, if you have a bunch of folding chairs outside and you don't have access to a table because there's, you know, a sweet potato pie on it, you can still play just with the cards in your lap, which is, you know, a logistic thing, but it's a thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely a good thing. I mean, you could have, you know, 2 people sitting on a sofa, 2 people sitting on the ground, someone in their recliner, and everyone playing the same game. It's definitely a valid point.
another thing that's really good about these games is not only can people jump in and out, but they tend to attract people because they're very like loud and boisterous activities, a lot of these. You know, when you're pointing at your mom screaming, "I know you're the spy," people are going to look.
Yeah, especially if you do it like in the grocery store. It's gonna get some attention. In a good way, though. In a good way.
And mom, I know you're the spy. You don't have to hide it anymore.
Perma spy. Yeah, I think that's one of the things, good things about games like Anomia and stuff too, is that it's people like see, it's a fun activity not only to participate in, but it's also kind of fun to watch. You know, I think Snake Oil is the same way. Like, I know there's a type of personality, and some of my family members have it, where they would never want to play Snake Oil, but watching their family members play Snake Oil, they would still have a blast. And I think that's sort of a good thing, is that, you know, the people who are playing can also be entertaining for the people who aren't playing, which is something to consider, you know, the family gathering, because you're not going to be able to grab, you know, everyone. Not everyone's going to be like, "Yes, Chris, I will play this game that you are telling everybody about." Who are the family members that you guys usually go to? Do you guys have like a stock of the family members that you know are going to be down to game?
Siblings, my siblings. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of them is in our game group, so that's a pretty safe sign that it's okay for him to. He's going to want to come and game. My younger brother is away at college to be a video game programmer, so he's also kind of a safe bet. So those are where I start. I gather the siblings first.
I have one cool aunt and uncle that I can go to.
And you know who you are.
Yeah, they know.
Not you, Aunt Sally.
There, you go to Dell's house and it's like, "Oh, those two people are wearing sunglasses indoors." Yep, that's the cool aunt and uncle.
Not just regular sunglasses, like the Kanye.
Yeah.
Like, the shutter shades.
The shutter shades.
One of my things is that my mom is like really, really big on in making sure that my friends know that they're invited to partake. You know, we do a lot of things. We get around. Eventually, my friends, if they want prime rib, they know that while their family is not celebrating, my family probably is. So, you know, I'll get a lot of friends that come over. And so usually I'll start with them, obviously, because they're my friends. I already know that they're into games. And then from there, I can usually just sort of coax my mom into it. And she's sort of like the keystone for me, because she kind of has to do whatever I ask her to do because I'm her only son. So I kind of I take advantage of that. And then once she's in, my aunts are pretty easily in. And then, you know, my uncles are like, once they see people having fun, they usually join. How do you guys go about pitching the games, though, to the family members that may not be, you know, the gamers? You know, Aaron, you know, not your siblings, but the people who are less likely to play. How do you sort of pitch those games and get people really, really involved?
Well, by the time that games come out at my family, everyone is, shall we say, well lubricated. So it's relatively easy to convince them to do something at that point. You know, after my Christmases double as a tequila tasting usually. So, you know, after four or five shots, it's pretty easy to be like, "Hey, you guys want to play a game? Yeah, football game's over. Let's do something else." And everyone will just kind of go with it because they're in that sort of mood.
Yeah. What about you, Del?
I kind of am the other way. I don't try and cajole people into it. If someone's down, if they're receptive to the idea off the bat, great. I'll, you know, deal them in. But generally, Aaron said at the top of the show, he said something about how trying to force people to play a game that they don't really want to be a part of is not the best way to get them into it. And that's important. You know, if your family, if a particular family member is just like, "No, I don't want to," you know, don't force them, because although we know how much fun they could be having, they might not be able to. There might be some block there.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point. I usually, like I said, I'll usually sell the family members that I know are down to play at least, you know, for a little bit. My mom, my aunts. I'm pretty honest and I'm pretty straightforward. And I tend to, I have a pretty good gauge at this point of what people are really going to be into trying and into not, or not into trying. But I think that sort of Dell hit on it pretty well, is that nobody wants to sort of get pressured into playing a game. That's one of the benefits of playing those games that people can see, you know, physically see you having fun and kind of take a look at it. And that's perfectly okay. I mean, you don't, not every game is going to be for everyone, you know, and this, the you know, obviously, you know, we, us three, are really about spreading the hobby. And we include, you know, spreading the hobby to our family members as well. So, you know, hopefully that you can take some of this advice and kind of run with it. Now, before we get to the what we're excited about portion, let's all give our top recommendation for a game that people should look into to playing with their family. Now, one caveat to this, and I guess we could have put this at the top, is that you know, games such as Trivial Pursuit, like my family, you know, used to play, games such as, you know, Pictionary, very popular Milton Bradley games, even Risk to some extent. I remember playing Risk on like camping trips and stuff with my family. We're gonna not really address those necessarily. Let's talk about games that we, as you know, quote unquote board gamers, are really into, that we also think our family would be into. Who wants to start with their top choice, their number one draft pick when it comes to family games for the holidays?
I can pick one.
Okay, Aaron, go ahead.
One that I would suggest is King of Tokyo.
Okay.
It is affectionately around our store referred to as Monster Yahtzee, because it basically is. It's a dice rolling game where you try to roll, you know, certain sets of things on the dice, except instead of just checking it off of your little scorecard, you're a giant monster trying to be the only monster left in the city of Tokyo. So you're damaging all the other monsters and scoring points and mutations and things like that. And it's really, really easy to teach people. And who doesn't love rolling a handful of six big green dice?
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. Del, what is your top pick?
Castle Panic.
Ooh, a cooperative game.
Yeah, it's co-op. It has a cool board that's kind of 3D, and people can kind of get into physically manipulating the monsters. The drawing from a bag thing lets you go, oh no, a troll, how could you, Uncle Jerry? You know, whatever. And everybody gets to celebrate when the castle is protected, or, you know, groan when the monsters kill everything.
All right, so Del went with Castle Panic. I'm going to go with Love Letter. And here's why. I think Love Letter, for those who don't know, is a very simple game. It uses, a dozen cards? Maybe a little bit less. But it's very, very easy to pick up the idea of it. It's easily transportable. I know a few people that you know, carry it around with them in their wallets, and it's the type of game where it's like you can play with pretty large groups of people, and you know, it's a very short game, and then people can kind of go about the rest of their business. But I would say that Love Letter would be one of my top picks. So if you haven't never played it, check it out, and it might be good for your family. Also, the artwork is not horrible, and it doesn't involve like anything bad, like Cards Against Humanity does.
You know, this conversation made me realize,
what's that?
How different it's going to be when like we're the patriarchs of a family.
Yeah,
it's,
man.
It's like it's crazy. Like, that's the central activity. Someone brings like a light game, and you're like, no.
You're like, never.
No, we only draft triple Mirrodin in this house, son.
My invitation is like, and bring your, you know, 50-point army with you. We will have 8 4x4 tables set up.
Yeah. Don't worry, we have all the death clocks.
It's a steamroller tournament at my...
You know, it's going to be interesting, you know, as gamers, as the people who grew up with tabletop face-to-face games, you know, become sort of the heads of households. It's gonna be an interesting shift in family gatherings. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if there's like an open market for games for those people that are designed to be played in family gatherings. Like, it seems like that'd be a very, you know, good sort of thing to shoot for, because family-friendly games and all. Anyways, please, if you guys have any tips for us, if you want to share with us what are your family's favorite games to play during the holidays, please let us know. We'd love to hear about your stories, about, you know, you screwing over your grandmother in some heinous play in a game of Lords of Waterdeep or something. I don't know. That's the first thing I came up with. On that note, we will head to the what we are excited about portion of the show right now. On to the what we are excited about portion of the show, and let's start with you, Aaron. What are you excited about this week?
I am excited about a digital game, I will admit, though it is a digital implementation of a card game, and that is Hearthstone.
I thought you were going to say MTGO.
No.
It is not the week to be excited about MTGO.
No. I mean, so many people lost their jobs. Anyway.
All right.
Enough about MTGO. That means it's an even better week for Hearthstone. I got in the beta a couple weeks ago. I know that NPC Chris has been in the beta for even longer. And I'm really enjoying the game. It's very polished. It's very fun, and I like that they take advantage of the fact that they are a digital product by doing things that a physical card game could not, while also kind of staying true to the genre. You know, there are cards that have, like, that essentially summon one of three random things, which would be a nightmare to do in Magic, but work perfectly in this digital game, and I think it's really good, and I think since it's free to play, that people should check it out when it comes out if they want you know, to play some card games and they don't have other people handy.
The thing that originally drew me to it is that it's a Blizzard game, and I'm a fan of Blizzard's products. Number two, though, is that I have my iPad, and I'm not a big, like, gamer on the iPad, but I saw that this, and I was like, oh, this is something that I could, you know, get into. I played Soulforge a little bit, and but Hearthstone is great because it has that Blizzard polish. Like, it doesn't feel like it's cutting any corners. And there's actually, like, gold cards in the game as well. But the really awesome thing that they do with Hearthstone gold cards is, instead of just being like a shiny version of the card with the same art and everything, they actually give them unique animations and sound effects and stuff. And so it makes it really, really cool. And it's a really interesting way to kind of add an element of collectability to some of the cards that are out there. I know Aaron's on the hunt for some gold cards himself.
Yeah, I thought I wouldn't care about them at all when I heard about them. And then I saw the first one and I was like, oh, these are sweet. So now every time I get a gold card, I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty awesome. In fact, I think we're going to be playing it a good amount here in the near future, but we'll see. What about you, Del? What are you excited about this week?
I am excited about a very limited print run of Magic cards that not a lot of people see or maybe even know exist, which is the Happy Holidays card. This is a silver-bordered card that gets sent out to stores and other major retailers.
Is that a cat in the background?
No, that's Archer squealing and smiling.
Oh, he's ready for Santa Claus as well.
Well, it's the family episode, so I thought I'd just let him be in the background.
Sounds good.
So, in the past, I still have my copy of Fruitcake Elemental and Gifts Given. Last year was the split card, Naughty and Nice. The thing they haven't done so far yet, though, is a Planeswalker Happy Holidays card. And so the previews I'm seeing are for Santa Claus, C-L-A-W-S, which would be a crab-fisted, gift-giving Planeswalker in this year's card, which is super exciting. I'm always on the hunt for them. I love the oddities and the super low print run stuff like that.
And where do they come from again? How do you get them?
Stores usually get one. Back when I owned my own shop, Wizards would send me, because I was a Wizards Premier store, one card as a thank you for running tournaments and selling their product.
Wow, that's pretty awesome. I've seen the fruitcake elemental. I've seen gifts given. So I've seen them, but I just never knew where they came from. So that's pretty interesting, and I love to see what they do with the Santa Claus, a planeswalker version of it. It just reminds me that I wish they would come out with another unset. I really liked those. On to what I'm excited about, and there's a new arrival in my local game store, and it is a supplement to the popular game Fate, popular RPG Fate. It is the Fate System Toolkit. Now, what started off, this started off as a Kickstarter sort of stretch goal. Initially, they had a set of rules for how to do magic within the Fate system that they wanted to incorporate. So they put it up as a stretch goal when they did their insanely popular Kickstarter. They had these magic rules, and they wanted to throw them in the book, but they also started thinking about other ways they could do magic rules, other types of things they can incorporate. And what they ended up doing was taking all of these little hacks and twists and changes to the system and putting it into one book that they call the Fate System Toolkit. So basically what it is it's a supplement that allows you or gives you the tools that you need to be able to hack the game of Fate. To those who don't know the terminology, hacking the system obviously means, you know, altering the rules in some way to suit your setting or your scenario that you want to run. The reason that this to me is so cool is because I love the idea that it's promoting the malleability of role-playing games. The idea that you can take a system and make tweaks to it to fit your playgroup. That's a really, really cool idea that I think a lot of us, a lot of us gamers who really think about these things a lot sort of take for granted. But I like how here they're putting it out in the open. They're saying, yes, you can customize our game. You know, our Fate core is designed to be flexible, and it's designed to be adapted to whatever you need it to adapt to. And this is a testament to that. So it's pretty cool. It's $20. It came out. There's a couple other books that it came out with as well. What were those again, Aaron?
They're the Fate World book. That's right. 1 and 2.
Yeah. So there's a handful of them supplements that just came out for the Fate system. But definitely check it out and see if it has things that maybe you can tweak for your Fate games to make everything run a little bit better. Yeah, so there you go. The Fate System Toolkit. That's what I'm excited about this week.
I like the design modularity, and it's funny how much better this kind of modular approach went over than the like D&D Next touted modularity. I feel like they did a very good job like essentially marketing this kind of modular approach to people and convincing them that it was the best way to do the system.
Yeah, I mean, I think if when you look at like the comments on their their actual Fate website and stuff, there's definitely people who are a little bit up in arms that, you know, because it's like, oh, I bought the actual rule book, but you have all these extra rules that aren't included in it, and blah 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 blah, and like all this sort of this negativity that we don't get into on this show, but I think that's the wrong way of looking at it. The way I see it is that the Fate core system is a complete set of rules, but they acknowledge that, you know, their set of rules is not going to be perfect for every particular group, and that you can be creative and you can change things that you don't like. And these rule sets, I was about to go off on a little bit of a diatribe, which I tend to do at the end of shows, but I'm not going to do it this time. Anyways, I like the idea that you can change things to work better for you and be creative, think outside of the box in really making the game system work for your group instead of your group work within the game system. So it's a really cool idea, and I'm proud of Fate for doing it. On that note, if you have been listening on iTunes, we greatly appreciate it. You can, of course, subscribe. It helps us with getting our podcast out there into more people's ears and hands and iPods and stereos and radios and boomboxes. You can, of course, give us a review on iTunes. We appreciate all reviews. Any and all critiques and criticism is greatly appreciated. Of course, if you give us a 5-star review, you can request a voice, and Dell will do his best in reading your review out loud. On the other hand, if you're listening on Stitcher Radio, like NPC Aaron does, like our good friend Marshall does, you can, of course, say, "This is sweet. I want to add it to my list," by pressing the plus button. You can also press the star button. Again, if you're not familiar with Stitcher Radio, tell us a little bit about that, Aaron.
Stitcher is like Pandora, but for podcasts. So you can not only search it for the podcast you want, but it'll suggest other ones to you based on what you like. And if you just let it play, it'll, you know, keep putting them in a row and giving you new podcasts to listen to. So it's pretty handy.
Yeah, it's super awesome. So if you haven't checked out Stitcher, check it out and look for NPCcast on there as well. Of course, there is one thing that we really ask our audience to do, and it's really the only thing that we ask our audience to do. And what would that be, Aaron?
It is to tell a friend, whether that be online through social media, letting people know, or just, you know, next time you're at your game group and be like, "Hey, this is similar to that situation they talked about on the NPC cast. What's the NPC cast, you ask?" You know, a very natural seg, mm-hmm. just like that.
Yeah. It's like, you know, if you're, again, if you're, you know, in a grocery line, just turn casually to, you know, the cute fella or gal next to you and say, "Hey, NPC Cast is a podcast I enjoy." And that'll just get the conversation started right then and there.
Well, my favorite is to be like, "Oh, you enjoy Kit Kats? NPC Chris enjoys Kit Kats."
Yeah, you can lie to him. That's fine. I don't mind. I'm just kidding. I do love Kit Kats. I love them so much. A good time to tell people about the podcast, of course, is while you're sitting around full of turkey or ham or prime rib or whatever it is you eat during the holidays. You can, of
Chinese
course,
food.
Chinese food, pizza. You know, it's all good. So, yeah, tell your family about us and we won't embarrass you. Your mom will actually be proud that you listen to such an upstanding podcast such as ours. On that note, you can add 1,000 experience points to your character sheet, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye. NPC Cast is written by Chris, Dell, and Aaron. You can reach us on Twitter at twitter.com/NPCcast or by email at thenpccast@gmail.com. As always, support your local game store.